It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Raindrops keep falling on our heads. Showers are in the forecast for most of the next week, on top of all the rain we've already had. It's caused sewer overflows and landslides. So what is the Allegheny County Sanitary Authority, or ALCASAN, doing to handle these problems? I'm joined now in studio by Jean Clark. She's Public Information Officer for ALCASAN. Jean Clark, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks so much for having me, Paul.
So how has this wet weather been impacting the region?
Well, it's really interesting because the wet weather in terms of the sewage system, we have only had two more overflows than we had at this point last year, even though we've had these horrendous rains. That means that a lot of the rain isn't making it into our system, which is good. We're tightening it up some, and but it's flowing into the rivers unimpeded. But it's not sewage water. It's stormwater, and that's where it's supposed to go. So when you've had these horrible rains and you look at the rivers and you see that they're brown, that's really mud and silt and vegetation. It's not sewage.
That's good news.
Yeah, that's good news.
When you say that you've been tightening things up, what does that mean exactly?
Well, we're in the process of working with our 83 municipalities to take a look at where we're overflowing, where we have stormwater coming into the system. Because we're in the business of treating sewage. We're a public health organization. But more than half of what we receive in our pipe comes from roofs, stormwater, breaks in the system, from a whole lot of different ways. And so the 83 municipalities have been under state and county orders to fix their systems. And we're working with the federal government on a consent decree. And so we've been proceeding, but we're still not where we need to be. We still have way too much stormwater in our system, and that's what causes the overflows into the river.
So what has to be done to correct that?
Well, in some cases, it depends on whether there are two different kinds of sewers in Allegheny County. There are combined sewers, which were built to have both stormwater and sewage water in them. And that's the city of Pittsburgh has mostly combined sewers. Mm-hmm. As you get to the newer communities, they have separate systems. The separate systems, though, sometimes there are breaks in the pipes, and they leak. You could get trees growing into the pipes. So you have to constantly be taking a look and seeing where these wet areas are. We're in the process. We've just finished a big study on where are the wettest areas, what can communities do, and we're just finishing that up. We're going to be releasing it to the public and all the communities, and ALCASAN's going to be offering help to those 83 municipalities. We're also in the process of taking over the big regional pipes. When we were formed in 1959, when we started action, up until that point, all but 2% of our sewers went directly into the rivers. So ALCASAN was created to put pipes along the rivers to intercept it and bring it to the plant and treat it. We're now moving up the next level. So where there are the big multi-municipal trunk sewers, we're offering to take those over and maintain them and repair them and start to eliminate all those overflows on the next level.
So with all the rain we've been having, and you say it hasn't posed the kind of problems people might imagine, which is good, but what concerns does this pose for our ecosystem? You know, what problems has ALCASAN been hearing about?
Right. Well, I don't want to tell anybody that the CSOs aren't a problem. They're a public health problem, and that's why we have a number of different ways to alert the public when there's an overflow. You can get text on your email. You can call into a hotline. You can go on our website, and you can get text or email, actually. And it will tell you when there's an overflow, when we've been able to treat enough, get it stopped through the plant and treat everything that's coming through. And then how long, 48 hours after that, we send a note saying that it's back to normal. because once you've had an overflow, according to public health, it's about 48 hours for the river to clear. So we have no governance. We can advise people and we can advise our municipalities. And so our advice is when there's an active overflow, stay out of the rivers. When we've stopped an overflow, you can go ahead and be in a boat, but you probably don't want to be in the river.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're normal, then enjoy the rivers as you want.
So how safe are rivers and streams at this point?
Well, if you talk to people who are older, they say, hey, they're so much cleaner now than they were before because so much of our industrial past, we just dumped stuff
sure.
into the rivers.
Mm-hmm.
But we still have a problem. We want to have great water quality. We want to have healthy water. And so we're moving forward. And that's what our whole region has to do. The problem with the regatta this weekend actually had nothing to do with sewer overflows. It was because there had been so much rain with so much mud, so much silt, and so much vegetation that it was actually dangerous to be in a boat in the river because you couldn't see what you might run into.
Okay, because you're referring, for people who are not familiar, you're referring to the high water levels, which at one point, I guess they were concerned that they'd be able to even hold the regatta.
Right, right. And basically, they didn't do the river part of the regatta. And that was a decision by the Coast Guard, the Fish and Boat Commission. Even Homeland Security was consulted on that. But, you know, some people, when they hear there's a problem with the rivers, they automatically think Alcosan. And this was one where, you know, we weren't warning people. There were some CSOs during that heavy rain, but really we've only had two more this year than we had last year at this time.
So what tips do you have for people to help prevent sewer overflow or landslides?
Well, obviously you want to take a look at the hydrology, the geography. When you buy a house, you want to make sure that you're doing everything you can to keep the water out of the system and also to keep it from damaging your property. So rain barrels are a great idea for people to be able to do that. But if you buy a house that's on a hill and you've got a huge hill behind it, you probably, as time is going on and we're seeing more and more of these extreme storms, you want to get an engineer out there to take a look at it. I have a friend who recently built a house in California on the Pacific, and she drove the pylons 27 feet down because of the landslide problems there. And then there are probably some places we shouldn't build.
Very interesting and practical advice. Jean Clark is Public Information Officer at Alcosan. And if people want to get more information just check on conditions, what can they do in addition to the app that you provide?
Sure. They can go to alcosan.org and sign up for our alerts. They can also find out there's a whole system of information about what you can do to help reduce stormwater in the system. And particularly, it's not too early to put September 19th on your calendar. That's our open house. And this year, we're competing against Cleveland. So when you got to go, you got to go Pittsburgh.
Okay. We'll have a link to that information on our website at WESA.FM. We've got to be able to beat Cleveland.
I know.
I mean, didn't their lake start on fire? I think that's an urban legend. Or is it?
No, I think their lake did catch on fire.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
So that we have the advantage right there. Jean Clark, again, Public Information Officer for Alcosan. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, who's watching you surf the web? We'll talk with Post-Gazette reporters Chris Potter and Rich Lord about their series, Surveillance Society. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The surveillance of U.S. citizens by the government has received quite a bit of attention in recent years. In 2013, comedian Alonzo Bowden addressed the issue in an interview here on Essential Pittsburgh.
And the NSA is listening in on your phone calls? No, they're not. You know why? Because you're boring. Because you're an average American. You have nothing to say. You know what I mean? You're not Jason Bourne. No one's listening in on your personal. And then the other side of it is, we at the same time, we have social media. Like, we're begging people to listen in on, please, look at my lunch. You know, look at a picture of the new car I bought. Like, we're begging people, look at me, look at me, look at me. The government's looking at you. It's an outrage. And again, it's unending how much of that goes on.
In our social media age and oversharing, how much information do citizens willingly give up? The Post-Gazette series Surveillance Society looks at how the government, private companies, and individuals are tracking the lives of everyday citizens. The series is being written by our guests, Chris Potter and Rich Lord, who are reporters for the Post-Gazette. Joining me now in studio, first, Rich Lord, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. How are you?
Great, Paul. How are you?
Good. Thanks for stopping in. And also Chris Potter of the Post-Gazette. Good to have you with us.
It's always good to be here.
You can join the conversation, that is you, the listeners, by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is ESSPGH at WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. Rich Lord, what led you to take up this very interesting series?
You know, as we reported in the last couple of years on any number of issues, from federal indictments of city officials to the ongoing problems with crime in the community, we noticed that everything we were doing was being observed. We used, for instance, in our own office, Google Docs to communicate with each other. And we realized that at a certain time that the documents, the communications that we often think of as privileged are not really privileged. They're shared with one of the biggest advertising companies on earth. Over time, our sources would ask us questions about who can and can't view the information, the emails, listen to the phone conversations that we share. And so we became interested in how the kind of surveillance net affects our own work and affects everyone around us. So we decided that rather than just cover this on a spot news basis, for instance, cover the city's camera privacy policy as a news story, we would look at every way that we are watched from the minute we get up in the morning until we go to bed. From the minute I go and I look at my e-reader to see what the weather's going to be like, and it asks me to enable its location feature, someone wants to know something about me, something about where I am, what I want, what I'm interested in. Why do they want to know that? What are they using that for?
That's a good question. And by the way, we use the Google Docs also. And,
sure.
And so we're sharing our information with as many people as you are. And Chris Potter, so what do we know about who exactly is, now that we know that we are being watched, who's doing the watching? Who's watching us watch the web or surf the web?
Right. So this is one of the things that we've been looking in and into quite a bit, is just how much, and Rich had a story about this recently, how many companies are actually monitoring the websites that you go to, including, full disclosure, the Post-Gazette itself. And a lot of them are tracking, for the purposes of placing ads, what your habits are. And in fact, that even the website hosts themselves often don't know who's on their websites watching you, because it's a very complicated process. They kind of, you as the website owner, open up your, you know, various locations on the page to an advertiser. They themselves may sublease that space to somebody else, who may sublease it to somebody else, and on that way. So what's interesting to me, and part of what got me intrigued about all this stuff, I mean, I take the point of the comedian you had in there before, that, you know, the government isn't really interested in you. But I think a lot of people don't really quite realize how possible it is to kind of integrate all this information. And that, to me, is sort of what we're trying to focus on. It's not just, oh, the NSA is doing this or Facebook is doing that. But I think what people don't appreciate is the extent to which all this information can be bought together. It's sold from one company to the next. I did a piece a week or so ago about the use of loyalty cards. And you think, here in Pittsburgh, everybody has an Advantage card, right? It's probably one of the emblems of being a Pittsburgher. They've been around for 20 years. They seem... And they're just part of our lives, right? And yet, it is possible to take loyalty cards like that and obviously build a history of what you've bought at Giant Eagle or any other store that, that offers these things. But what a lot of places are doing now is they're combining their own data based on your purchase history at their store with data they buy from elsewhere. So what Chris Potter bought this, that, and the other at Giant Eagle, but he also did Google searches for this, that, and the other. And taking that information, it's possible to build a profile that doesn't just say, here's what Chris Potter's bought here. It's also what Chris Potter is interested potentially in buying, and maybe we sort of push some discounts towards him to encourage him to do so at our store. And the argument there, of course, is, well, this helps me because now you're offering me deals that I might be interested in. The flip side of that, though, is that, A, it's information that I'm not necessarily sure that I'm cognizant of giving up, mm-hmm. and B, there's an implication on everybody else who shops at that store, because obviously to the extent to which a company gives discounts to you or I, they got to make up that money somewhere, so perhaps they pass on the extra cost of that to other customers who aren't being afforded that kind of thing. So this, what interests me is that the extent to which we're all implicated in this system, even if we don't necessarily participate in it voluntarily or knowingly.
So if information is being used to create different pricing, or in fact to maybe charge us more for a product based on what a merchant endeavors to find out about us online or electronically, specifically how much we're willing to pay
right.
for a particular item. Is that illegal? Is that like insider trading information?
It's not illegal, as our colleague Deborah Todd wrote about in Monday's paper. It's only illegal if the information is sorted in a way that then sends us a price that's based to some directly or indirectly on, say, race, ethnicity, gender, or some protected class that we're in. But no, targeting you for a given price because of data that suggests that you are willing to pay more than someone else is not per se illegal. And that appears to be what's occurring and part of the focus of what's called online behavioral advertising going forward.
Why is there like a little just nagging voice inside of me that says that's just really creepy?
Yeah,
maybe it's not illegal, but is it unethical?
It feels this is interesting. I mean, one of the weird things about this about reporting on this series so far is when you talk to people who are supporters of the industry, mm-hmm. who believe in the value of this stuff, they'll say things like, I can imagine a future in which we don't even have stores posted in Giant Eagle in our grocery stores, because you'll just go around with your phone and click on them and it'll tell you what it'll cost and it'll be tailored to exactly what you want. And then you go and you talk to the privacy advocates and they say, I can imagine a future in which there are no prices attached. To them, it's a total dystopian view of what could happen. And I think the reason it's creepy to you, Paul, is because one of the accomplishments maybe of the 20th century, some people would say, is what's called the democratization of the marketplace. We go into a store, everybody gets charged the same price, everybody sees the same stuff on the shelves. And that wasn't always the case. You know, there have been times in a variety of concepts when if you were buying real estate or whatever, it was being redlined. If you were of a certain racial group, you wouldn't necessarily see this house. You wouldn't necessarily get a chance to buy the swank car in the lot. They just wouldn't show it to you. So part of, I think, what's going on here is there's a feeling that you are maybe not being given the deals that other people are getting. You're maybe not being offered the same kind of offers. And you don't even know why that is. You don't even know what the algorithm is that said, yes, this guy gets the good offer, this person doesn't. And there have been a couple of cases where the retailer's ability to do this has kind of infringed on people's privacy. There's a sort of very famous case first reported by the New York Times Magazine in which a teenage girl started getting special offers from Target that were about maternity and if you're expecting a baby and da-da-da-da-da. Well, her father comes to Target finally and says, what are you people doing? My daughter is getting all of this stuff and she's not pregnant. And according to New York Times, it turned out that in fact she was pregnant, and Target, based on her purchasing behavior, knew it before her own father did.
Wow.
How
Orwellian is that?
Right. And the only thing that makes it not Orwellian is it was a private company rather than the government. So.
And when I started this, Paul, I thought, well, there are laws that protect me from creditors, say, or mortgage companies or would-be employers using information that they would buy from a data broker or something like that to make a decision on whether to hire or lend to me. So how could I be really hurt by this in a material way? But one privacy advocate pointed out to me that there are many gaps in the legal framework. There's nothing that says that they can't use data purchased from a data broker to decide whether to send my son to a given college or to accept my son at a college. So there are huge areas of human activity in which these vast data profiles can be used that are completely the Wild West right now.
Wow. It's really so much of this is a revelation. We're talking with reporters Chris Potter and Rich Lord. They work for the Post-Gazette and have put together a regular series called Surveillance Society, which looks at how the government, private companies, and individuals are tracking the lives of everyday citizens. You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email esspgh@wesa.fm, on Twitter at esspgh. Let's go to the phones. We have Josh from Pittsburgh. Josh, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, Paul. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
Okay, so I'm a computer science student and software developer, so I wanted to briefly mention some effective tools for increasing your privacy online.
Do tell.
All right, so if you're online, one of the things you can do, or two things you can do, is use some tools to help hide your identity. One of them is the Tor browser bundle. Tor works by relaying your request for a website through several different servers so that the end website can't see who you are. And also VPN services that are used to basically hide your identity, for example, from your internet service provider. As well, you can also move away from proprietary tools like Google Docs and use open source tools like LibreOffice. The idea being that the source code is available so professionals can audit and make sure there's not code that's tracking information about the users.
So now Josh is offering, now he has expertise in this particular field, but he's offering some very practical advice. So Josh, stay with us here while we kind of work through this. For the average person, how likely is it, of course they can tune into Essential Pittsburgh and hear this advice and or read about suggestions that are made in your stories and possibly apply that to their own situation. But realistically, how many people are going to take the time to undertake these precautions and be proactive? And which leads to the question of, are we really giving away our privacy? And do we care? Are you getting the sense that people even care what they're putting out there?
Not enough, and hopefully some of that will change. And we're working with our sources at CMU to develop a set of tools and some reporting on what you can do to protect your privacy. And we got some really good tips there. Kind of the flip side of some of those tips are using some of those tools may put you on the radar screen of law enforcement. Law enforcement really hates the Tor browser, for instance, and is trying to paint it as a tool of ne'er-do-wells. And that can get you potentially watched. But there are also ways to reduce the amount that you're tracked. You can use the Firefox browser rather than Google. You can use the search engine DuckDuckGo, which doesn't track you at all, rather than the Google search engine, for instance. You'll get a less tightly tailored set of results, but you with a good search, you can still generate the kind of information you can with a Google search without generating the data trail.
Josh, I'm guessing that your peers are probably as savvy as they come when it comes to being proactive about protecting your information when you go online. Are you getting the sense that most of the people that you talk to are concerned about this, or do they go online or browse the internet willy-nilly, just not really caring about who might be tracking them?
Unfortunately, I get the sense that, my peers in the computer science field do care, but, the average person around me doesn't as much. I do want to mention that, even with these tools, the changes that need to be made by the average person, are behavioral. You are going to sort of have to change your behavior to use privacy tools like Tor or to use open source software. So for the average citizen, it is a change, but I think it's an important one that people need to make.
So it comes down to being an individual choice.
Correct.
Yeah, Josh, thank you. Thank you very much for chiming in and giving us some very useful feedback on this.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, the tough thing about that, and I think it's important for people to be aware, obviously, or we wouldn't be doing this series, but I mean, the tough thing about that, this idea that the consumer, it's really up to the consumer to do this is, I mean, you've looked at privacy policies. We all have. And you start really, I'm going to read through this thing all the way. And you get about two paragraphs in, and then you realize how much of that slider bar you have yet to go. And you just kind of think,
right, right.
And this stuff is, I mean, somebody, one of the researchers we've spoken with has kind of done a study of how long it would take you to read all the privacy policies that you would be exposed to in the course of just an average amount of sort of web usage or whatever. And it's just ridiculous. No human being has that amount of time. Even a service like Tor, it's tough for people. I mean, the whole point of the internet is it's accessible to all, but to use these tools, it's not. It requires a degree of competence that, frankly, I'm not sure I have personally, and probably a lot of other people would just be worried about anyway, about their own ability to get the thing to work.
Well, and part of going online, say to shop, isn't that the idea of the convenience?
Yeah.
Exactly. It's supposed to be easy to do. It's the reason you don't leave your house. But if you have to take all these precautions, then why don't you just you know walk down to Macy's or drive over there to the mall? And, you know, do your shopping the old-fashioned way with cash, and then nobody can track you.
Right. And this is why.
Unless the surveillance cameras pick you up driving over to the mall, and then that's like a whole nother.
Or pick up your location within the store, which we haven't reported on this yet, but there is that technology is out there. The ability to use a radio frequency ID or whatever to sort of track your behavior within a store. Where do you move? What kinds of shelves do you look at? What kinds of displays command your attention? All of that kind of stuff is stuff that if the place you shop doesn't do now, will have the capacity for doing in the foreseeable future. It's a brave new world out there.
I wasn't even aware of that.
Yeah.
I guess it's coming, you're saying.
I mean, a lot of this, one of the things we want to be careful about, and I've sort of had some of the experts I've spoken to sort of caution me on, is not becoming fatalistic about this stuff, because it's easy to look at this technology coming down the pike and just say it is just so pervasive that there's no way to escape it, so I shouldn't even bother to try. I think it's important that we not have that attitude. And I think it's important also that we don't just say that it's the individual's responsibility. Of course, we all have a responsibility for what we do, but I don't think that can end there. There probably needs to be at least discussion about what kinds of regulations should be in place at all. The White House has come up with a privacy bill of rights that's being debated, and some people think it goes too far and some not far enough. But I think we should, whatever kind of conclusion we come to as a society, we should also be talking about those kinds of regulatory reforms.
If you want to join our conversation with Chris Potter and Rich Lord of the Post-Gazette about surveillance society, as it's called, looking at how the government, private companies, and individuals are tracking the lives of everyday citizens, our number, 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter @ESSPGH. Audrey from Greenfield in an email wants to discuss internet voting and wireless connections in voting systems that many legislators are beginning to bring up. And I'm guessing that what she's getting at here is that voting is supposed to be private, but, you know, depending on how you're doing it in this day and age, your voting patterns, your voting habits, your political, political inclinations can be tracked. Is that true, Rich?
And voting is a public act. The fact that you voted, when you voted, what party you're registered, that's a public piece of information. Now, who you voted for is a private piece of information, obviously. And there's been concern ever since electronic voting took off that the black box software, the software that hasn't really been disclosed outside because it's proprietary to the companies involved, isn't secure enough. We haven't broken new ground on that, but what we learned from looking at how politics is conducted is that these data trails, which you're leaving when you shop, when you subscribe to magazines, when you go online, are being picked up by companies that are selling them to politicians. We've sat there and looked at databases downloaded by political action committees that show thousands of voters, hundreds of data fields, everything from your education level, your presumed income level, to whether you're interested in fishing, whether you do your own home remodeling, and your presumed religion. These are databases that political candidates and political committees are purchasing really cheap nowadays from the data brokers that agglomerate all this information about you. Those databases are then used to target you with robocalls, with mailers, but they can also plug directly into Facebook. And these political campaigns can now say, I want to hit every, in this given district, I want to hit every woman in the age range of 25 to 34 who's ever expressed an interest in the environment and has a kid. And they will plug that database into Facebook through these interfaces that exist, and bang, their ads will show up on those people's feeds. So while we don't have new material to break at this point on the security of the electronic voting systems, your every preference, your every online and even many of your offline acts are now feeding into the political process.
We've also seen the flip side of that. Not only can politicians buy information from private companies and things like that, they also sell their own databases of who were donors, who called me up and said, I'd like to put your
sell those
sign out
to
there.
The businesses?
Yeah, we haven't seen so much of that happening, but you can imagine there are some niche products, guns, or if you're in the market for selling gold, you can imagine there are certain politicians out there whose supporter list would be, if I was Winchester and wanted to send a catalog to somebody, I might well send it to somebody who is supporting a particularly ardent defender of gun rights out there. The other thing, too, I just had to build off of what Rich said, is from our standpoint as reporters, the ability to micro-target these ads creates a real sort of accountability issue for the candidates themselves. You know, you want to be able to fact-check the claims that a candidate makes in an advertisement or whatever. But the more these advertisements get micro-targeted, the more of them there are, and the harder that process of tracking those ads and the claims in them gets to be. I mean, sometimes we've had situations in recent election cycles where a candidate will say something in a Spanish language commercial that goes out on the radio, and what they say in Spanish is maybe a little different from the message they're foregrounding in English. Imagine that multiplied by all the ability to micro-target various demographics out there, and which messages are being sort of pushed on particular people, and how do those messages change depending on who the audience is. So it really, the ability to micro-target this stuff really creates the capability for a candidate to sort of seem to be all things to all people to a degree that we're not even used to dealing with now.
Well, when it comes to the sharing of information, I mean, what sort of structure is in place to prevent that? Is it anything goes, or is it limited? How does it work?
If you're above the age of 13, then, and you submit data, then a company can do anything with it that it wants to do, except for make a credit decision or a hiring decision, as long as it doesn't violate its own privacy policy. And as we mentioned earlier, privacy policies can be complex, they can be opaque, and unless that privacy policy says, I will not do this, and the company does it anyway, there's really no mechanism for the FTC to enforce it. The whole system is based on notice and consent. We told you what we were going to do with it, or we didn't rule out doing X, Y, and Z with your data, and you clicked on the accept button, and therefore you consented. So, you know, it's fair game now. The problems with notice and consent, there's a couple of problems. One is, I've got young kids. My kids are on the internet as much as I am, or more. How can they adequately and intelligently digest this notice and consent system and respond to it intelligently? The other problem is, the internet isn't just in your computer anymore. It's going to be in your light switch, your garage door opener, and your refrigerator in a couple of years. And those devices won't have an interface by which you can understand what's going on with your data and consent to it. They're just going to do with your data what they're programmed to do.
Just because a business is collecting data about consumers does not necessarily mean that they're doing something diabolical, does it?
No, that's right. And in fact, you know, one of the issues out there is sort of data minimization. A lot of times these companies collect data without really knowing what they do with it. They collect it because they can. And maybe one of our slick software engineers, one of our data analysts will figure out some patterns based on this stuff. And then this information will become useful down the road. And this is any time, Rich is kind of what Rich was referring to, is called the Internet of Things a minute ago. These smart appliances, these ability for these things to collect data. And a lot of them... there's a lot of discussion right now about, should we constrain the amount of data that can be collected on the front end? And a lot of times the companies say, no, don't do this, don't do that, because that will prevent our ability to innovate down the road and to use data in ways that we cannot even begin to comprehend at this point, at the sort of early stages of really advancing this kind of technology.
So what can and should be done to raise awareness and to protect consumer rights? You mentioned earlier the White House initiative to draft a consumer privacy bill of rights. Various politicians have weighed in on this. You've talked to them as part of your Surveillance Society series. So, you know, what policies are you hearing? What ideas are coming forth about how to go forward with this?
The ideas that seem most promising aren't emerging in Washington. The Washington process, the Obama proposed privacy bill of rights, has been widely panned in the privacy advocacy arena. The interesting ideas seem to be coming up through the states. California, for instance, has a legislation that governs how education technology providers can use the data that comes out of the apps that my kids bring home from school. Illinois has rules for how biometric data, data on your face, data on your fingerprint, data on your retina and your voice can and can't be used. Pennsylvania's got practically nothing. And over the next couple of weeks, we're going to be asking a number of questions about that of our legislators. And I think that if you want to look at this on a societal level, if you're a listener out there who wants to do something, you got to start at your state legislative level.
Why isn't Pennsylvania doing more?
That's a great question.
That brings laughter.
Because it's Pennsylvania, man. I mean, no, it's a really good question, and we're looking into it. It is very difficult. One of the issues I'm looking at is the use of smart meters, which are meters that are able in real time to report your usage of electricity or other utilities, and it
regulates your use depending on, you know, you run your dishwasher at 3 a.m. when not everybody else is running their dishwasher.
That's right. And
information can be gleaned from that process.
Exactly. One of the concerns privacy advocates have had about those things traditionally is, well, that tells you a lot about when I'm home, when I'm not home, all that other kind of stuff. There has been some effort to kind of cobble together some sort of privacy type protections there. It has not really gone anywhere. And I think it's just we are not terribly this state just has not been terribly sophisticated about those issues. And I'm not quite sure why that is. Like, as Rich says, it's something we'll be looking into in the weeks ahead.
Wouldn't you think, though, with our governor, with Governor Wolf, who's sort of this much more tech savvy, 21st century mindset governor, regardless of whether you agree with his policies or not, I mean, wouldn't you think that he'd want to be more, that his administration would be more proactive on this?
Governor Wolf's campaign was certainly very savvy with the use of technology, using Facebook, using other social media platforms. So they know how these things impact life. They know how these things impact the political process. And we would expect, with CMU being right here in Pittsburgh and some of our nation's most knowledgeable privacy advocates and some of our best privacy research coming out of CMU, that this would be on the radar screens of Harrisburg. We're going to try to put it there.
It's tough, though, because it's not at the top on anybody's agenda, right? We've got a governor now dealing with a budget and all these other kinds of things. This is not an issue that has mobilized a lot of people to call. People aren't marching on Harrisburg demanding these protections the way they are on other issues. So it's not something that I think is just generally on politicians' radar, partly because we don't put it there.
Well, perhaps after hearing this segment and reading your series, again, it's Surveillance Society. We've been talking about the Post-Gazette reporters who have and are continuing to put it together, Chris Potter and Rich Lord. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us today on Essential Pittsburgh. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having us all.
Coming up, a business profile of Regent Square. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Coming up, business contributor Rebecca Harris. But first, each week, 90.5 WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. The series explores the city's lesser-known history, connecting its past to its present.
Wow. Matt Klein and William Alba are developing a new kind of firework at Carnegie Mellon that will light up the sky higher than ever before. Though they expect a certain outcome in the lab, Alba says part of the joy of fireworks is unexpectedness.
You might hear them launch, but the sky is still dark, and then all of a sudden they blossom, they bloom.
Humans have enjoyed the thrill of blowing things up since around 200 BC. The Chinese discovered, while fire-drying bamboo stalks, that they exploded if left too long. Between 600 and 900 AD, Chinese alchemists created gunpowder and codified the happy accident of combustion. Fireworks and modern warfare were born. Marco Polo brought fireworks back to Italy, where the art of pyrotechnics evolved.
Italian alchemists started adding metal salts to fireworks. Things like copper, which created the blue color, strontium the red, barium green.
Dr. George Zambelli Jr. is chairman of Zambelli Fireworks International, a fourth-generation family company based in Newcastle. He started working at the plant when he was 12 years old.
As I got older, we'd get up early in the morning, drive to a location, fire the display, actually go back to the firework plant. And we used to sleep on the wooden tables that fireworks were handcrafted on. We were almost like gypsies.
Newcastle, according to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, is the fireworks capital of America. Between 1890 and 1921, nearly 100,000 Italians migrated to western Pennsylvania. Many worked in the mills or mines, but some, including Zambelli's grandfather Antonio, carried pyrotechnic recipes and built fireworks companies.
I remember him coming back from fireworks displays and the smell of gunpowder on his clothes.
I think it's man's mastery over nature. you could mix this stuff together and it can create something really dangerous, but at the same time, beautiful.
70 miles southeast of where the Zambelli Company fills a string of barges with fireworks on the Ohio River, another kind of firework maker, the exacting hobbyist, sits on his front porch. Michael Unka first started making fireworks in the early 2000s. His daughter Kate is his pyrotechnic sidekick and studied chemical engineering at CMU to expand their knowledge.
My dad would always ask me questions about the periodic table and, like, what chemicals make what color when you light them on fire, and how does magnesium work and why does it burn so bright? And so I was like, well, I mean, if we really want to try it, then I should probably learn a lot more about it.
At its most basic, a firework is an oxidizer and a fuel, maybe a compound for color, and the Unkafers make it all.
So you buy a fuse and you start experimenting, and one thing leads to another, so.
Like a 4th of July fireworks show in Blairsville that annually draws more than 400 people. The Unkafers are currently on hiatus. It just got to be a little too much, they said. But Kate has a memory of her dad from the finale of that last show.
He always stands pretty close to the fireworks. He was up on the hill and I was down on the road selling shirts. And he had his arms outstretched and was just laughing.
On July 3rd, 1776, the day after he voted for independence at the Continental Congress, John Adams wrote to his wife Abigail that, forevermore, the anniversary ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade, with bonfires and illuminations from one end of this continent to the other. You will think me transported with enthusiasm, he wrote, but I am not. For 90.5, WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. I'm Margaret J. Krause.
UPMC is proud to support 90.5 WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. According to Pittsburgh Magazine's recent city guide, tree-lined streets, proximity to Frick Park, and bustling business district are some of the standout features of the Regent Square neighborhood. As part of her monthly focus on neighborhoods, contributor Rebecca Harris is here. She's the director of the Center for Women's Entrepreneurship at Chatham University, and she's looking at Regent Square. Welcome back, Rebecca.
Nice to see you, Paul. And I love Regent Square. It's such a great little find. I think if you haven't been there, you must go.
I do love it, too.
I do,
too.
The
movies, the places to eat. Yeah. Let's begin this neighborhood focus looking at the historic background of Regent Square.
Well, it was really a collection of farm properties in the late 18th and 19th centuries, and it began to emerge as a community in 1832, and that was when Judge William Wilkins purchased about 650 acres in this area, and it expanded further from that when William Harmon of Harmon Realty acquired the Devon Plan. That is what it was called at that point, and it became Regent Place, and that was later changed to Regent Square. And as we all know, Henry Clay Frick, who lived in the Clayton home, which is right near Regent Square, he gave about 150 acres of to the city of Pittsburgh near his home, which became Frick Park, which is right on the edge of Regent Square. And now that park, which is such an integral part of the community of Regent Square, is about 550 acres. We've really added to it. But by the mid-20th century or so, Regent Square was really a very quiet, prosperous garden suburb. Many of the people who lived there worked at Westinghouse, and George Westinghouse actually encouraged his employees and his executives to live there. And in some of the larger homes, they were called Holy Homes, and they were built by a builder named George Schleiber. So it's kind of an interesting history. So there you have it.
And what about the demographics of Regent Square?
When we really look at it, it's an interesting anomaly in some ways, because it's a very distinct neighborhood, but it's also, according to the Regent Square Civic Association, it's a neighborhood that includes portions of municipalities of Pittsburgh, Edgewood, Swissvale, and Wilkinsburg. So I think that's interesting because it really includes all of those. So there's four municipal governments that are really a part of it. There's three school districts, but it has a very strong cultural identity, and it's bolstered by a really active community association. So it gives it a very distinct neighborhood feeling. And you know, with the grid street plan, and you talked about it in the Victorian and the tween wars architecture, the houses are very close together and the porches are closed and together and the tree-lined streets. And it really promotes a sense of community and neighborhoodness. And I think it's like a small village in some ways. So that's nice.
And South Braddock Avenue is the main thoroughfare of Regent Square.
It is. It is the hustling, bustling part of Regent Square.
And so what can you tell us about the main businesses? Of course, the theater, the Regent
Square Theater
is there.
Is really one of the places you must go. And if you haven't been to the Regent Square Theater, it's one of the largest nonprofit art houses in the region. And it's one of the last great single screen movie houses, Paul. So remember, we used to have lots of those. So, and when you look at the foot traffic up and down the streets, you see coffee shops and bakeries and cafes and yoga studios. And there are shops like the Animal Nature Store in Regent Square, which sells healthy pet foods and supplies. And you can actually go there and do fundraisers for homeless animals. And then we have Glenn's Green's Stained Glass Studio, and they do a lot of renovation on stained glass and restoration. And then, of course, we have to talk about the Square Cafe, a woman-owned business, which
right.
has amazing food. And, you know, you can do vegan, veggie, gluten-free, and just regular great. The Regent Square Civic Association is very active. And I think that really accounts for so much activity in that region, from the Easter egg hunts and the civic Halloween parties and the holiday house lighting contest. Also, there's a lot of other community organizations. And I think as a part of a neighborhood that has strong community organizations, that's really what you look at. We found the Wilkins School Community Center, the 9 Mile Run Watershed Association, the Environmental Charter School at Frick Park, and then certainly the Frick Environmental Center. And if you've been by there lately, wow, is that undergoing changes or what?
And then we got about a minute left. So in that time, provide us with some interesting facts that we don't know about Regent Square.
Well, from Memorial Day weekend through September, on Friday nights, there are porch parties that have become a staple for those who live on Celeron Street. And what happens is people get together every Friday night, and they last till about 11 o'clock. They're celebrating their 100th anniversary this year. So I think that is pretty neat. They have the 28th annual race, which is coming up on August 22nd. So if you don't know about that, you must go. And finally, the first screening of the Pittsburgh Silk Screen Film Festival will be held at the Regent Square Theater this Friday.
There you go. Now, one last thing about Regent Square or close to that area are the clay courts. And these are city tennis courts. And they're, you know, it's very rare to find a clay court, but
very
they have
rare.
Them in that area.
Yeah. And it's a wonderful place for everybody to get together and then have ice cream afterwards and kids play. And what a great neighborhood it is.
Rebecca Harris is the director of the Center for Women's Entrepreneurship at Chatham University, looking at Regent Square. Rebecca, as always, great thanks.
Thank you.
On Wednesday, July 15th, 90.5 WESA is holding a community forum on the impact of the Americans with Disabilities Act on our city. The ADA turns 25 this year. How far have we come and what remains to be done? As technology progresses, how should policy evolve? The forum will take place here at the Community Broadcast Center. It will be broadcast live on 90.5 WESA starting at 7 p.m. Doors open at 6:30. Space is limited, so please register to reserve your place at wesa.fm. Until next time, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.